Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. On this edition, we speak to journalist and author John Gibler. John is author of Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt. John speaks about the drug trade and horrific violence you've been hearing and seeing on TV. He ties it into economic policy and the normalization of state repression, both in Mexico and places like Canada and the U.S., so stay tuned.
My guest is John Gibler. He is the author of Mexico Unconquered. John Gibler is an international journalist. He's also a global fellow in human rights, and we reach him in the United States. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's great to be on the air with you.
Now, when you write in your book, Mexico Unconquered, about the culture of resistance of Mexican people, you're talking about this constant spirit of revolution that lives in spite of centuries of oppression and imperialism. Where is the struggle for human rights and justice in Mexico today?
Sadly, the struggles in Mexico today face an increased onslaught of state and now kind of quasi-state repression. The drug war over the past 4 years now of Felipe Calderón's administration has created the pretext, similar to the so-called war against terror in the United States, for recasting the army's role in society, as well as militarized federal police presence in civil society, to justify an overwhelming mass militarization of the country, again, in the pretext, the name of fighting drug trafficking, such that now it's a common sight in cities across the country to see huge convoys of military Humvees patrolling the streets of the city with 50 caliber machine guns mounted on the hoods, and federal police convoys of, you know, fully masked and armed federal militarized police, again, patrolling the cities. Things that were for years associated with the militarization of zones in especially southern rural Mexico, sites of resistance, organized resistance, such as the EZLN, or the Zapatista Army of National Liberation in Chiapas, or other armed and unarmed movements in places like Oaxaca and Guerrero, where the government had heavily militarized the rural countryside, starting even as early as the 1970s, vastly increased in Chiapas after the 1994 rebellion of the Zapatistas. And that has been maintained since then. There's been much discussion of a kind of, quote, low-intensity warfare, unquote. Low-intensity is a questionable concept for those suffering the daily impacts of such intense militarization, but low-intensity in comparison to full-on combat zones, I guess. And the recent explosion of violence related to the drug trafficking industry has created the largest pretext to militarize Mexican civil society since the 1994 rebellion, such that in zones across the country, social movements as well as armed movements now feel not only the pressure of an unaccountable state that feels fully justified to openly patrol the streets and military convoys, and these quasi non-state or paramilitary actors that are the assassin hit squads for the various drug cartels.
When I think about this open militarization of the streets, I think of the relevance of this story to people worldwide. I don't think that the aggression against Mexican people is an issue that only impacts locally. I think that it has greater implications for us as a society. What does it mean to live in a society that sees
power, a kind of fascism that, you know, if the people disagree with you, well, they can be forced by military force to conform to policies. I wonder if you could talk in particularly about the uprising in Oaxaca and the significance this has in the context of the ongoing militarization within Mexico City under the pretext of the war on terror or the war on drugs.
First off, since the country is becoming so accustomed to completely unacceptable, outrageous levels of violence, it's the daily headline. The daily average now is between 20 and 30 executions nationally. And what that means is that amidst so much violence, it becomes easier to hide, quickly distract the populace from targeted political violence. So there have been a number of assassinations throughout the country, both in the north and in the south, in states like Sinaloa and states like Oaxaca, of indigenous leaders, of labor leaders, of rural farm organization leaders, shot dead in the street in their offices. And it doesn't even so much as create a blip in the media response and coverage to so much violence. Since you've got events such as the mass execution of 72 migrants in Tamaulipas State last summer, daily execution totals in the, you know, between 30 and 40, and massacres that are happening almost once a week, such as 14 children to be shot dead at a birthday party in Ciudad Juarez, or 11 young workers shot dead at a car wash in Nayarit, places like Nayarit that were never associated with such levels of violence. One thing it does is it just completely desensitizes civil society and the media to political violence. So there's actually been an increase in targeted assassinations of social movement leaders intensely over the past 4 years, but even in just the past year, it's gotten much worse. And the capacity to respond in any kind of an organized framework, both nationally and internationally, with human rights organizations and solidarity organizations, seems to be, at the moment, almost entirely disarticulated. Egregious events like the open attack on a human rights convoy that was taking food and medical aid to a community that's been under siege by paramilitaries for several months now in Oaxaca and San Juan Copala. This human rights caravan was attacked by paramilitaries last April, and two human rights activists were assassinated, Betty Carino from Oaxaca and Giri Zakola from Finland. You know, a decade ago, that would have been a huge international scandal. And in the context of drug war massacre, something like that, you know, barely makes a headline for a day or two. And then also the risks associated with organizing are even more heightened now in this context. Whereas impunity was almost guaranteed, now it's 100%. The national totals for homicide cases that are even investigated, where there's just some kind of a paper trail, is only 5% of homicides, and those relate to the drug war. So now we're talking well over 30,000 executions in the past, you know, nearly 4 years, and 95% of them are guaranteed impunity because there isn't even an investigation. So in that context, pushing for government accountability becomes a life or death matter. I interviewed a couple of months ago a man in Sinaloa who works for a Sinaloan human rights organization, the Frente Cívico Sinaloense, and one of their leaders was Ricardo Murillo, was advocating for justice in the case of a military massacre in the rural region of Sinaloa, Badiraguato. He went on the radio and denounced the massacre itself, but then, of course, all of the mechanisms of impunity afterwards, where they tried to fabricate confrontation scene, you know, turning a family that had been shot dead in their vehicle into supposed drug traffickers, but it all fell through. And within days of Ricardo Murillo's denunciations on the radio, he was shot dead in the head, left outside of a gas station. And his organization, the Frente Cívico, then not only continued with their work advocating for justice in the case of the massacre in Badiraguato, but now also in the case of their fallen colleague, Ricardo Murillo. One of these men, Salomon Monares, I interviewed, he was shot in his house at 6 in the morning 6 times, left for dead. Miraculously, he survived. And after almost a year of going into hiding, recovering from his operation and going into hiding, he's now back in Sinaloa, once again at the Human Rights Organization. And these are cases where, again, 10 or 15 years ago, this would have been on the tip of everyone's tongue nationally. This would have been an international scandal. You would have had campaigns at Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and organizations like that. And now you've probably never even heard of this organization or the people working there, because the onslaught of violence is so intense. And such an intensely bleak and grim picture, is the good news is that people on the ground in Sinaloa, in this case, aren't giving up. You know, even in such horrid and violent context, people are still organizing, fighting back, pushing for justice. But it is probably the heaviest and most perilous moment in Mexican political organizing that I've witnessed in more than 10 years of traveling and working on issues there.
I wonder if you could talk then about the structures, you know, the economic and political structures that enable this kind of onslaught and a grievous kind of oppression, you know, to continue and to be so exacerbated. What are the structures that maintain this?
I think that's an excellent, urgent question. It's also intensely complex, but to try and sketch what I think to be some of the overarching structures here. I mean, first, consider, you know, Mexican political history. You could start with, you know, more than 500 years of colonialism and imperial invasions. And I think in the context of the Americas, it's always important to kind of anchor ourselves there and start from that historical fact. Jumping forward to the 20th century, Mexico created its modern state. As you know, importantly point out, this is the bicentennial of Mexican independence and the centennial anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, and the modern Mexican state that was formed out of the experience of the revolution was an intensely monolithic and authoritarian state with certain tippings of the hat to a kind of almost quasi-socialist state, and socialist in the sense that vast state programs were established in the early 20th century, but with a firm hierarchical structure such that not only was the federal government in charge of every kind of policy related to labor or social organizing in farm working areas, but I mean, and not only policies, but organizing itself. The federal government controlled all of the national union structures, but not only the federal government, it is like to the top tip of the pyramid, the president and the figure of the president itself, which rotated every 6 years with no re-election. In 2000, with the election of Vicente Fox, there's this kind of myth of a democratic transition, which does not last very long. Of course, the 2006 elections, which took place under extreme allegations and documented allegations of electoral fraud. And even if the fraud itself were to be taken with a grain of salt, and one were to give Felipe Calderón the benefit of a doubt, he won by less than 1 percentage point. And that itself was of only, you know, less than around 30% of the voting electorate, which was, you know, maybe 12% of the population. So it's a political structure rooted in authoritarianism, with a desperate attempt to convey itself, portray itself as democratic, but with among the weakest actual electoral democratic institutions. And then, of course, in the context of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which began to be structured in the late 1980s, signed in the early 90s, and, of course, went into effect on January 1st, 1994. So here you have an odd combination of a fiercely authoritarian state and an economic doctrine of supposed free trade. Of course, there's not very much free at all about it. Capital is able to move across the borders with very few restrictions, while labor principally is strictly prohibited at the border, such that when workers cross the border, they become illegal. As you were mentioning at the beginning of the song, talks about that you played for Manu Chao. So this NAFTA restructuring of both the Mexican and the United States economy at the same time created abilities for a kind of renewed capitalist colonialism across Mexico, but it also created a displaced labor force that was then, in effect, exported to the United States, where it's, you know, institutionally exploitable by virtue of it, laborers themselves being considered by a state illegal. You know, in this context, drugs. Drugs are commodities, and they're part of their commodity form, and what makes them so intensely valuable, besides the fact that people like them a lot and they seem to be of high quality, is the fact that they're illegal. And the illegality of drugs has been tied, you know, explicitly to United States domestic and foreign policy from the beginning of the 20th century, with its deepest roots in racism. The first law on the books in the United States, and as far as I know in the world, prohibiting consumption of a narcotic was in the city of San Francisco, California, against opium, which is part of an early campaign in the late mid-1800s, racist campaign to break off and dismantle the economy of the Chinese migrants in the West Coast, California. And of course here, Chinese migrants using a product that was kind of forced on them by the British several decades earlier. Jump forward to the 1960s and Nixon in the White House, and you have a drug policy created as a way of recasting legalized discrimination against people of color in the United States into a politics of mass imprisonment or mass incarceration, and an ideology to demonize and group any people who are, you know, taking the streets and marching for political reasons as, from the get-go, illegitimate, because they too are illegal by using some kind of illegal narcotic. And again, Manu Chao hits it when he puts in with these, you know, migrants he's calling are illegal. The state called them illegal. It says, you know, marijuana illegal. That was one of the, you know, very effective tools of the United States government to create the ability to raid houses, try and dismantle the Black Panthers, attack people associated with resistance movements fighting the Vietnam War. So drugs as commodities, with illegality a part of their commodity form, is very much linked to forms of state repression rooted in United States and domestic policy, but also United States imperialism. You know, jump into the 1980s and 1990s and forcing United States' so-called anti-drug position becomes a way to justify military intervention and participation all over the world, principally in Latin America in cases like Colombia and Bolivia and now Mexico. So you have a dual function of a commodity itself that, by being illegal, is intensely lucrative, and the state itself benefits from tremendously, not only through cases of individual corruption, but also just through the broader economy. The drug economy is so huge. It's the minimum estimate from both U.S. and Mexican government statistics is between $30 and $60 U.S. billion dollars a year in cash, and that becomes a kind of constantly renewed savings account for the global economy. And in 2008, during the economic recession, the United Nations Special Office on Organized Crime detected an estimated $352 billion U.S. dollars in cash successfully laundered into the economy. In effect, what that says is that, you know, drug money saved the banks in 2008. Drug money kind of rescued global capitalism from its crisis of overaccumulation with the housing bubble in the United States and all that. So it becomes, drugs are great business by virtue of being illegal, and they're also great politics from the perspective of an imperialist state that wants to justify sending their military all over the world and being able to attempt to criminalize both political movements such as, you know, the FARC or armed guerrilla movements in Mexico, although they're completely unrelated and born of a very different political context, but also people of color and resistance movements inside the United States itself. There's just a book released earlier this year by a woman named Michelle Alexander here in the United States called The New Jim Crow. And she builds an argument showing how the slow dismantling of legalized discrimination against African Americans and other people of color in the United States through the civil rights struggles was almost immediately reformed and recast into this drug war politics of mass incarceration, such that it's now once again legal to intensely discriminate against the vast majority of the population of African Americans, because so many, especially young African American men, go through the penal system as felons, as people accused of committing federal crimes, and the federal crimes are, you know, cases of minimal, minor drug possession. Somebody who maybe had 1 or 2 grams or less than a gram of crack cocaine, and now you're a felon and you can't vote and you can't get food stamps and you can't apply for any kind of federal student aid, housing support. Once again, it's legal to discriminate against an entire segment of the population.
My mother said there's no mal que dure 100 años ni enfermo que lo aguante. There's something like there's no illness that can possibly last 100 years nor a patient that will tolerate it. And in the case of Mexico, the increase in repression points to me to the great inequality, the great economic inequality that we see. And I wonder if you could talk about that, the connection between this economic inequality and the, I guess, resorting to drugs as a possible alternative.
Absolutely. In a way that's very similar to what the United States did in the 1960s, 1980s with draconian drug laws to criminalize people of color, largely the African American population in the United States. Mexico doing something very similar along class lines. The people most intensely feeling the brunt of the violence directly and of the state's waging of the drug war are people of working class conditions, people who have had very few to no economic opportunities. And when you look, for example, you know, a kind of micro case, if you look at Ciudad Juarez, which is the most violent city in the country right now, and take a look at the map of the city and where the executions take place, and while they take place throughout the city, something like 90% take place in the marginalized zones on the periphery of the city that were built up around the maquiladora industry starting in the 1970s. You know, this is a war against the poor, and it's largely a war against the young. I think the deepest, or definitely part of the deepest roots of how the drug economy functions ideologically is precisely by ignoring the economic and social causes that lead individuals to try and participate, usually at a very low level in the drug economy, people who are getting in as, you know, street level dealers or maybe low national traffickers or people sometimes moving things across borders. But these aren't the capos making $200 million in cash every 3 months. Ignoring these social and economic roots, people who feel they have nowhere to turn and who have such an intensely low esteem for the institution of the rule of law, because when they look at the state, what do they see? They see police repression. They see government military convoys parading through the streets and the things that the soldiers and the police are now famous for doing, rape, assassination. This isn't just in Mexico. It's only recently, I mean, the cases like this across the country, but intense case in the last year in the San Francisco Bay Area where a transit police officer shot a white transit police officer shot a black man who was completely restrained, already on the ground, hands behind his back. The police officer shot him in the back and killed him and was acquitted of first-degree murder. That is their vision of the law, the rule of law. So somebody says, you know, hey, run this across, this, you know, across town, or run this across the state border, or, you know, this is pot. It's so intensely mainstream now. People don't see that as a morally offensive or in any way illicit thing. They see the illegality itself, the law itself, as the morally offensive thing. The crazy irony is that, you know, the people on the lowest levels of the drug economy who are not getting rich but are risking their lives and, you know, become the ones demonized in the media, they're not making money. And the people really economically benefiting from the entire system are things like, you know, Citibank and Wachovia, the large international banking institutions that, you know, as I already cited, pretty much stayed afloat during the 2008 recession as a result of black market cash, largely from the drug trade.
Can you talk about the resistance? Because I think at the same time that we see the state imposing this horrific forms of totalitarian power through militarism, we're also seeing an ongoing movement of social movements throughout the country.
Absolutely. No, I'm glad you bring it back around to that. I think that resistance is everywhere in the last, again, in the Mexico context, Mexican politics. I was just traveling throughout the country for about 5 months, reporting on issues of the drug war and reporting on them from a perspective of movements and resistance to anti-capitalism. And there are pockets of resistance all over the place, as you said. I think one of the principal challenges people in resistance movements face, and I'll switch here to the first person plural that I think we face, is organizing, creating stronger links within our movements, tighter organizational capacity, and then broadening those capabilities out by creating links with other movements that aren't in the traditional solidarity model, but are really in the model of some kind of horizontal collaboration. And the second thing, just very personal, one person here, but very personal reflection, I think resistance movements, we need to slowly question traditional modes of activism, everything from, marches and rallies to, forming 501c3 nonprofit organizations, as they're called in the United States, or the non-governmental organizations. I think these structures and these practices, while they might be useful in certain contexts, they form a kind of potential alleyway with no exit in confronting the state we're now facing. And that's, I think, an urge to push against those boundaries and become fiercely creative is definitely needed.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is John Gibler. He is a reporter. He has written a wonderful book, Mexico Unconquered, which chronicles not only the incredible struggle of people fighting totalitarian oppression from governments, but also, I think, the culture of resistance that needs to be nurtured, fostered, and maintained throughout the world if we are going to create a society that is inclusive for all voices. How can people access your book?
It's published by City Lights Press in San Francisco, California, and it's available through their website, but it should be at, most of the electronic bookstore places, if that's the way you want to do it. Otherwise, at your local independent bookstore or library.
Thank you again for being with us. Take care.
Thank you so much. Take good care.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.